James Lee Burke writes detective novels set in New Orleans and the surrounding bayou. Joyce Carol Oates described him as one of the gifted contemporary writers responsible for revitalizing the detective genre by bringing in issues of politics, gender, race, and morality. Oates writes, among even his talented contemporaries, Burke is something special. His new novel, Dixie City Jam, is his seventh featuring Cajun detective Dave Robichaud. It just made it onto the Publisher's Weekly bestseller list. Burke got a late start in the field of crime fiction. His first novel was published in 1965, but he went through long periods when no one was interested in bringing out his books. One book was in play for 9 years and was rejected by 100 publishers. It wasn't until the mid-80s that he started writing detective novels. I spoke with him in 1992, after the publication of his novel A Stained White Radiance, in which Dave Robichaud investigates a Klansman-turned-politician and a TV evangelist. Here's a reading.
If you grew up in the Deep South, you're probably fond, as I am, of recalling the summertime barbecues and fish fries, the smoke drifting in the oak trees, the high school dances under a pavilion that was strung with Japanese lanterns, the innocent lust we discovered in convertibles by shattered lakes groaning with bullfrogs, and the sense that the season was eternal, that the world was a quiet and gentle place, that life was a party to be enjoyed with the same pleasure and certainty as the evening breeze that always carried with it the smell of lilac and magnolia and watermelons in a distant field. But there is another memory, too. The boys who went nigger knocking in the little black community of Sunset, who shot people of color with BB guns and marbles fired from slingshots, who threw M-80s onto the galleries of their pitiful homes. Usually these boys had burr haircuts, jug ears, half moons of dirt under their fingernails. They lived in an area of town with unpaved streets, garbage in the backyards, ditches full of mosquitoes and water moccasins from the coulee. Each morning they got up with their loss, their knowledge of who they were, and went to war with the rest of the world. When we meet the adult bigot, the Klansman, the anti-Semite, we assume that he was bred in that same wretched place. Sometimes that's a correct conclusion. Oftentimes it's not.
Do you know anybody who you grew up with who you feel became as an adult one of the kinds of fascists that you're writing about?
Oh, I knew many people who grew up to be like the boys that I describe here in this piece. But these kinds of people are victims themselves. These are fellas, or sometimes women too, who are inept and not quite functional and see themselves as being disenfranchised, and they never know who they are unless they feel superior to some other group, and they're by and large innocuous and bumbling guys with banana peels for fingers. It's hard to look upon them as villains. They're almost, like buffoons rather than villainous people. The kind of individual who bothers me most is the one who's calculating, who knows better, and who is of insidious intent. The person who perhaps has sociopathic tendencies, who insinuates himself into the mainstream of society. And he has one message always. He teaches others to fear and to hate our fellow man, and to blame others for our own misfortune.
Now, Dave Robichaud, your detective, is drawn to people who are psychologically deformed in some way. I mean, he considers people like that to be like his extended family.
That's right.
The walking wounded, as he describes them. Is that an affinity you feel yourself?
Well, let's face it, who are the most interesting people in our midst? People who get up every morning and do things in a normal way, or the deeply neurotic and brain-fried, the people who begin each day with a nervous breakdown, people who were shot out of a cannon 5 minutes ago. I think they're always more intriguing. I don't know. I've always felt that it's difference that saves us from ourselves. I mean, God help us if we ever become too enamored with normalcy. It's always the person who has the outrageous and eccentric view of the world who leads us away from ourselves, always. Whether it's, we're talking about Newton or Christ or Socrates, it's always the person who does everything backwards, who says no to the status quo, that has something to say. Bernard Shaw once said, "We learn from the irrational man and woman. They reject the world as it is. They do not adapt themselves to it. They seek to change it.
I want to just quote a line from your new novelist, Stand White Radiance, and this is in a paragraph where Dave Robichaux, your detective, is talking about how his extended family is people who have a peculiar difference in their makeup. Mm-hmm. And he's talking about every time he thinks that some kind of constitutional sacrifice can be justified for the greater good, he wonders what his eccentric friends would say. And he says, then I realized that the rhetoric of the greater mm-hmm. good would have no effect on them, because for those who were most deeply injured as children, words of moral purpose too often masked acts of cruelty.
That's right.
Tell me how that observation came to you.
Well, anyone who spends any time, with 12-step groups or in analytical therapy or analysis is going to discover something about the nature of cruelty and how oft times it masks itself as love. And we all at some time in our lives have to deal with the nature of power and authority. And so very often people who suffer the greatest psychological injury in their lives are those who were treated erratically as children, not in a way that was consistently abusive. They were often hurt in some way, psychologically, physically, but were constantly told that this was an act of love, that it was being done for the child's own good. That person grows up with his head in a microwave. And the consequence is, as a rule, he has trouble with authority, defining it. He may spend a lifetime rebelling against it, or he may embrace it. He probably will misuse power himself. And one theme in the book deals with how an injury done a child is like a stone bruise, and it perpetuates itself in the person's adult life, where the injury is compounded, and this is why, you know, forgiveness and atonement and reconciliation among ourselves, to my mind at least, is so important. That person doesn't have to play the hand he's dealt with. You can put it away and say, how about 5 new cards?
I want to get back to your novel for a second.
Okay.
There's a group of characters who you describe in the novel as the pool.
Oh, yeah.
Let me ask you to describe the kind of person that you're talking about there and how you came up with that thought.
Well, I used to be a social worker in South Los Angeles, and the pool, these are the brain fried. These are the guys who, you know, arrive on this planet like, you know, a cannonball going through a stucco wall. They leave behind whole warehouses of paper, all kinds of records, parole and probation officers, marriage counselors, psychiatrists, social workers, bail bondsmen. These guys are the people with banana peels for fingers. And we think, my heavens, what are these guys doing in our society? But they provide employment for millions of other people, for guys like me who was a social worker. People who complain most about these guys would be bereft if they disappeared, if the pool went away somewhere. I mean, how about all our policemen and psychiatrists, marriage counselors? What are they going to do for a job? That's on the kind of on the light side, but.
But you know, in a way, the way you're describing them, in a way, is not unlike the way you describe the kinds of eccentrics who
sure.
you're most interested in yeah. having as an almost extended family.
Yeah.
Are they the same people?
Sure, and I knew some great guys on Skid Row in Los Angeles. Yeah, East Fifth Street, as Woody Guthrie once said, is the skiddiest of the skids. And there was this one guy, I won't use his name, but he was a master at manipulation. And he would come into the office and demand that we place him in our best hotels, you know, our welfare hotels. As soon as he checked in, he'd throw all the furniture out the window, box springs. One time he ripped the laboratory out of the wall. It'd come crashing, you know, down onto the cement from four stories high. And then he would run downstairs and haul it all to the secondhand store. This guy was...
Oh, to sell it.
To sell it. This guy was so infamous that in South L.A., the cops wouldn't arrest him because... This is kind of distasteful, but if they didn't cuff him right and he could get a finger down his throat, he'd throw up in the squad car.
Oh, God.
This guy was so awful, the jailer at Lincoln Heights didn't want him in his jail. He said, I couldn't take this guy anymore. This was, I mean, that's a victory, a guy that could undo the system the way this one man could.
So it sounds like your relationship with him was more of like a novelist to a character than a social worker.
Sure. I knew hundreds of people like this guy, just truly extraordinary human beings.
Could you communicate with him?
Oh, yeah, sure.
Did you feel like you understood him?
Sure. And it's like any policeman will tell you that he knows many, many people like this man I describe. And that oftentimes there's a kind of symbiotic and sympathetic relationship between cops and certain kinds of people who inhabit the underworld. And they both sometimes understand the existentialistic rush that they get participating in a kind of nether society, a place that ordinary people don't put much time into. And that... You know, it's something interesting about being on the Full Tilt boogie all the time.
So when people could sense in you that you were not the straightest guy in the world, you know what I mean? That you were kind of eccentric yourself.
Well,
do you think,
I don't know, maybe.
But do you think that they would use that to try to take advantage of you?
No.
Or do you think that they would have more of a... feel more kind of sympathetic or affectionate toward you because of that?
Most people I knew in that world had a wink of the eye at mm-hmm. respectability, and if you could share it with them, they knew you both had a kind of a Sancho Panza view of things.
James Lee Burke, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thanks for having me, Terry, on your show.
James Lee Burke, recorded in 1992, his new detective novel is called Dixie City Jam. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.